Representative George Rogers, Chairman of Mississippi House Education Committee from Vicksburg, interviewed by Jack Bass and Walter DeVries, March 27, 1974.
In what way? I think Key's book, like I say, is very good in understanding. Anybody wants to understand Mississippi politics needs to read that book. And of course, Revolt of the Rednecks. So. Trust you've read that. You familiar with Revolt of the Rednecks?
No, I haven't.
I've not read it yet. I've not read it. I've seen a number of references to it.
It's a very poorly written book. It's very good. It's background on Mississippi politics. It's sort of a history of the populist era. Vardaman and Bilbo and that era. And you can't really understand Mississippi politics without that background. It just goes a great deal more into depth about that background of the 20th century Mississippi politics than Key does.
And to what extent does the old Delta versus the Hills components remain?
It's broken down to a great extent. It's not nearly what it was, and like I said in that article, I think several contributing factors. I think the pay of the landlord has attracted more people from other sections of the state to get in the legislature and stay in it. And this is, you cannot be a committee chairman or really be an effective member of the legislature unless you're some unusual bird, unless you had some experience. It's just really almost impossible, in my opinion.
Let me ask you this.
And the knowledge of the rules of parliamentary procedure and just the mechanics of how legislation is passed, and just a feel for people's reactions, is so important in getting anything done. You got the time, you got timing elements, you got to know who to see when, and all these things that you don't learn without just being here and having the experience. And you don't sell things on the floor by oratory, I mean, unless it's a very crucial, close vote, and you might swear to people. But I've, you know, rarely seen the outcome of legislation affected by the actual debate. Now, I've seen legislation killed by a skillful use of parliamentary procedure during consideration on the floor, but you don't sit down on the floor of that house and discuss things rationally, and then everybody makes its mind after the debate. That isn't the way that it works, and I don't think it works anyway that way. But certainly not in an unruly body like the House of Representatives with 122 members. And so that's why experience and, as I say, knowledge of the parliamentary procedure is so important in being effective. And of course, we still operate under the, we've broken it down a lot, but it's still basically based on the old rules of the House of Representatives under Uncle Joe Cannon, you know. That gives the committee chairman and the speaker tremendous power. And if you got all the chairmanship, you know, still works that way in Congress, despite the way they liberalized the rules up there. Now, that's the key to power. And the key to committee chairmanships is long service, being in with the in group. The other thing that gave the Delta the power, of course, and the way the compensation works in with it, I think, is that a lot of people of independent means from Delta would get elected to the legislature. They could afford to be in the legislature as an application. And they could afford to stay down there. And they could afford to spend a lot of time in it. They weren't so worried about making a living. And the more time you spend at the job, the more fat you get off. And that's what gave the Delta the kind of hold their head on the legislature, was this, core, you might say, professional legislature. They really weren't dependent on it for their living, but they were down here for playing for keeps. And you didn't have that type of people coming from the rest of the state to the legislature. That has broken down to a great extent. I think people have waked up. You got a more intelligent electorate than the rest of the state. And you've got enough compensation that the guy doesn't have to really. And a lot of people are not really digging into their own pockets to stay down here. They can at least break even, so on the proposition. And so you're getting people from other parts of the states to get down here and learn what it's all about, and they have enough ability to be able to be effective, and so that disperses the power.
When we walked in, you're saying that there'd been more substantive legislation passed this year on education than since you've been here.
Well, except for the one session where we established the Minimum Foundation Program in 1954. Since 1954, that's maybe a little broad, but more, I'd really be more fast, say, more innovative.
What specifically?
We passed what we call the Learning Resources Act. And this is designed to be a very large-scale program of setting up a complete division in the State Department of Education on learning disabilities, with teams of experts at throughout the state, perhaps six or eight different locations, whose function will be to go out and screen kids, get them at the earliest possible moment, diagnose learning disabilities, and not only diagnose it, but once it's diagnosed, write prescriptions, and then follow up and see that the kids get what they need to overcome their disabilities to the extent that they can. And we're finding that in education more and more that, the dunces weren't stupid, they had some sort of learning disability. And there's so many different types. Kids could go through the third or fourth grade, not being able to see or not being able to hear and never catch them. And of course you've got all this business of dyslexia, just begin to learn something about, and that covers a multitude of different things, I think. And if you catch these kids early and do something about it, you can save them. But if they just stumble through and are socially promoted up to the sixth or eighth grade, they either drop out or they flunk out. They never learn anything. They never learn to read. Very significant program. Passed that, and then we passed the state. We discussed the Learning Resources Act. Then we passed the state manpower program. I don't know whether you're familiar with the federal manpower program, so called, but it's a program for training and retraining adults to upgrade their skills for employability. That was a big federal program, and like so many federal programs, they're popular for a while, and then they get on some new tack, and even though it was a very good program, it's unpopular now, and federal funding has slacked off, and even for the original Manpower Act, it's expired, and now they've got another program similar to that through the Labor Department, but it's different, and you know, the federal government never sticks with anything very long, it seems. And so we have passed a state program to supplement and take the place of the federal program if it's ever abandoned in this field. Well, this is, you know, I think very significant program. It's something that's going to be very significant for the future of the state, particularly for the black population. And it passed almost, you know, without a dissenting vote.
What sort of funding level did
what we did this time, the Senate passed just a flat $2.5 million appropriation. We're a little more conservative in the House about, particularly about new programs. I don't ever believe in doing, like, you know, the federal government acts. Again, I might think I'm anti-federal government, but in a way I am, because I have to contend with the vagaries of that program all the time, particularly in the field of education. And it gets frustrating, I'll tell you. But, you know, sometimes they seem like they think, you know, oh, they're going to have instant programs, and they just throw a bunch of money against the wall and say, we're going to do this. Well, it doesn't work that way. Now, you know, you've got to create an institution when you start a program of the magnitude and long range effects that you're trying to get out of anything like this Planning Resources Act or this Manpower Act. And so we, in the House, we cut the appropriation back to $2 million and said that 50% of all funds from the federal government that we were able to get, if we were able to get them next year, nobody knows whether they're going to be available or not. We think they will be, but that's one of the problems with the federal government. You know, you can't plan ahead. You know, we didn't have any education appropriation for 18 months. The federal government went without an appropriation for education, just on continuing resolutions. And you can't plan anything like that if you don't have an appropriation. They passed the appropriations halfway through the fiscal year they're supposed to be funding. It's just utter chaos the way they're running the country. But anyhow, so we did that. We said, you can spend the whole $2 million. If you don't get any federal funds, you can spend $50 million. Now, what that will do, and we really think we'll get about the same funding in the program we got last year, hopefully. That was about $1,800,000 for this state. So if you figure it that way, we'll get $1.8 million. Half of that will count against the appropriation, so we'll have a brand new state program be funded with $1,100,000 as a start. And I believe in starting any new program, you know, on a fairly modest basis, so you don't rush out there, you know, and build it up. And then we'll see, take a little look at it next year, and with the idea that it proves out that if implemented properly, we'll increase the funding.
What do you think is the most popular misconceptions of Mississippi and Mississippi politics outside of the state and inside of the state?
Well, I think that the only thing is that outside the state, people still have the Bill Bowen and Ross Barnett image. And I think that, hopefully, that's the thing of the past. The changes have been so rapid, of course, in the state, you can't fault the rest of the nation for not realizing the extent of political change that has taken place in this state. It's nothing short of phenomenal, in my opinion. I served in the Ross Barnett administration. I'd hate to have to go through that again.
How do you compare that period with present?
Well, it's just different night to day, in my opinion. It was a racist atmosphere, and of course, people actually, you know, want to preserve it almost during the marriage crisis and so on and so forth. And everything you did was colored by this. And now the race issue is just way down on the bottom. It's practically disappeared. It's still there to a certain extent, but you can't even put your finger on it. You have to dig real deep to find it. And of course, what's been mad is the Voting Rights Act. When it likes to get the vote, they got to look. My district is about 50% black. You think I'm going to get up there and yell against the blacks? In fact, I was caught in a bind that brought out a stupid resolution, and they used to have stupid resolutions all the time. They brought out a resolution that was really fairly mild, calling for the repeal of the Voting Rights Act. And that put me on a terrible spot in my district. Because the Voting Rights Act, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, is a highly penal, very unfair piece of legislation. It wasn't the way Congress wrote it, but the Supreme Court, and that is one of the worst opinions the Supreme Court ever wrote. They just, legislated. They took the Voting Rights Act and extended it far beyond what Congress ever intended. And it puts us in a very great straitjacket trying to run the state. And so we finally amended that thing, but I got backlash from some of my black constituents for having voted for the resolution. And I really think, the way we finally amended it is proper, and if you can ever explain those things, explain it even to the black constituency, but it's hard to do. A lot of votes against the resolution, which, the Barnett administration haven't been unheard of. But just because of that, the way we finally amended it was that it either ought to be repealed, it ought to be extended to cover the entire country. And they ought to free us from they ought to go back to the original intent of the act and make it apply only to procedure of registering and voting, because sure you're aware of it, we can't change a voting precinct location anywhere in the state without getting the Attorney General of the United States permission. And that's just no way to run a state. And I'm sure Congress didn't think that we would have to run up to the Attorney General every time we change the location of a polling booth. That's what the Supreme Court said. We can't expand any municipal city limits without getting the Attorney General's permission. We can't change something I've been trying to do for years, is to get all superintendents of education appointed rather than elected, to upgrade the professionalism of your school administrators. We can't do that without getting the Attorney General's permission. Did you realize that? And as far as I'm concerned, that has nothing to do with race or politics or anything else. It's just something to be good for the school. But we've got to get the Attorney General's opinion. I could go on and on and on. We can't change the method of electing school boards without the Attorney General of the United States approval. We're just almost a colony. And it's not right. Now that the blacks have got the vote and they have more political, they have more potential political power in Mississippi than practically any other state, because we've got a large percentage probably of black registered voters than any other state in the country. And we're not going to be doing a lot of things we used to do. It's no longer a practical problem, but the rest of the country doesn't realize it.
A lot of people told us that the black vote in Mississippi really hasn't made its impact felt anywhere near to its potential.
Well, not to its theoretical potential, because if it had, you know, at least 20% of the people down on the floor of the house would be have black faces. From that one point of view of looking at it, but it's had its effect, I'll guarantee you, amongst those white people down there. But they're out there representing black constituents. Don't think they aren't. The politician that wants to get reelected, he listens to the guy who's got the votes. The reason the blacks don't have any more influence than they do is that although they, by massive drives, they got a lot of them registered, you go look at the poll books, you'll see that that's about all a lot of them ever did. They registered, but they've never voted in a single election. They just don't exercise the franchise.
In the 22 years you've been here, is that the biggest single change you guys do at Breeze?
Yeah. Of course, it's the most significant.
Has it made it easier to consider educational matters?
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
How?
Well, not. Well, that in the completion of the integration of the schools in Mississippi, the virtual completion of the integration, because we're not worried about integration anymore. We're not worried about race directly. In fact, there are a lot of people out there in the house now worried about, you know, what can we do to get these black people better educated that never worried about it before? What can we do to get these black people better jobs? And, you know, when they weren't voting, nobody was very much worried. They should have been, because the depressed economic condition of the blacks in Mississippi was what one of the biggest contributing factors to everybody's, I mean the whites' economic plight. And just a complete drag on everything, on the entire economy.
What else besides?
People didn't look at it that way. They look at it that way now, though.
You mentioned two significant trends in the legislature, the shift of power away from the Delta that I once had, removal of this racial issue. Are there any other major trends that have occurred in the last 25 years in this legislative scene that you would say?
Well, of course, then reapportionment had a tremendous effect.
What was the effect of reapportionment?
Well, just to give the urban areas a real voice in the legislature, which they didn't have. It resulted in just more favorable consideration of the problems of municipalities and legislation, which will help, which could help the municipalities. It's resulted in a diminution of the great influence that the Board of Supervisors had over the legislature, which was reflected at this session by several significant measures. The passage of a bill to require boards of education to approve all leases of 16 section schooling. That's something I've been fighting for 20 years.
Would you explain that legislation to us a little bit? Because that, my impression is it is significant, but I'm not, don't really understand exactly what it is and what it does. Or
well, do you know what 16 sections are?
Yes. All right. It goes back to the Mississippi becoming a state. And when 16 states set aside.
The Northwest Ordinance set aside every 16 sections.
For school purposes.
For school purposes. Most states sold them. We didn't. And there's 700,000 acres of land in the state. Dedicate every 16th section except in the Chickasaw section. The northern tier of counties, they sold theirs, unfortunately. But the rest of the state, every 16th section, is one section out of 36 is dedicated to support of schools. Well, although we didn't sell them, historically back in the 1840s, they gave 99-year leases on them. A lump sum, which in effect was just a part of the title for 99 years. But those leases have now expired. But the trouble was that for those 99 years, It didn't produce any income, nobody was interested in it. And after, but it was only when they started expiring and people started getting interested in them, but in many areas, and the board of supervisors, the ones that controlled the releasing of them and the leasing of them. And they just handed these lands, at least for these lands out in many areas, as political favors. Or else they treated them as if the original 99-year lessees and their successors entitled owned the property. So, you know, they weren't going to take it back from them. And we do have the problem in many areas that a lot of people went out and built homes on them. And, you know, in the rural areas, they didn't even bother to check the title. People started giving warranty deeds to them. People probably thought they were buying land that they didn't own. Some did. You know, if people live well enough, you know, this lease got 50 years to run. I'm not going to be worried about that. But then the 50 years runs out and they suddenly, you know, I don't have any rights in this land anymore. So it had gotten to where there wasn't much revenue, and it's just been a constant fight to try to get the land back under the control of someone who will use it as it was intended to produce revenue for the schools. And the board, as I say, the board of supervisors, the thing about best in their control in the board of supervisors, they don't run the schools. They have no direct responsibility for the quality of the schools or the school budget. So, you know, what does it matter to them that they're not getting it? Well, it's the board, school boards that have got to worry about balancing the school budget. They're the ones that are directly interested in getting producing revenue from this land. So by passing a bill saying that no lease will be approved, you know, can be entered into without the approval of the school board, we've really, finally put a stop to giving these lands away.
That was passed this year?
Mm-hmm.
So the impact of that is it's going to provide a significant new source of revenue.
Yeah, that's right.
What sort of potential revenue do you see coming out of this, projecting ahead?
Well, I really hadn't tried to project it. Of course, this doesn't apply to all the whole state. In many states, the Board of Supervisors have been trying to, you know, carry out that trust. The Delta, for instance, they've had a separate law for years where they have to advertise for bids. They can't give anything but short-term leases. And they get tremendous revenue out of that. Practically every county in the Delta, my county, over here on the river, our Board of Supervisors for the last 20, 30 years has been managing property. Our lands are primarily timberlands. Not farmland. The last 10 years, our county alone has gotten over $1 million out of 16 section lands. It's built, it's provided the local money to build several schools without having to have a bond issue. So, I mean, if every county did as well as our county, I should say that, you know, total revenue throughout the state in about 62 counties is better. We're going to approach them getting an average of about $200,000 a year now. We could see total revenues for 16 section land was 200,000 times 60.
12 million, I think.
$12 million a year, something like that. Well, this way we're probably getting $3 or $4 million.
But in the political significance, the fact that you could meet the supervisor.
Well, no, that's the political. That's the political significance. You get back to that. The political significance is it would beat the supervisor. And that was just one bill. The other one was to set up a purchasing control and auditing bill, and another bill to provide penalties against violations of the contracting law on home supervisors. And all of these bills passed this state.
So does that, to some extent, reflect the impact of reinforcement?
It to a great extent, it does.
What was the 16th century? 16th section land goes back to what federal act?
The Northwest Ordinance.
Could you have thought, say, 10 years ago, that the massive social change which occurred in the last 5 or 6 years, principally 1970 when you integrated the schools, could have occurred at that time? If you look back, think of that period.
I would never have thought it would have occurred so peacefully and been so well accepted. That's the amazing thing.
Because this was supposed to have been the worst place in the South and in the country, and yet we find, you know, the curve was almost without really serious incident.
Well, you see, we fought our battle in the front end. We had problems, but we were fighting about it in 1954, and, you know, up through, well, the marriage crisis, that's when the thing was. But I always said that the rest of the country couldn't realize what we were fighting about. But see, we had legal segregation in Mississippi. We were integrated geographically. And the only thing that kept us segregated was the legal barriers. And it was just a gut realization, I think, on the part of the people in Mississippi that once these legal barriers went down, we were integrated. And that's why the battle was fought when the legal barriers were being attacked. Once the legal barriers went down, everybody said, well, you know, that's it. We better make the best of it. The battle still has yet to be fought in the North because the barriers there are not legal, but social and geographical. And they got that problem in front. Well, they're just beginning to cope with it, you know. They're just getting integration orders and busing orders, and it's causing the same sort of reaction there as the original integration orders did down here. And of course, it's just like, you know, the great fear is the fear of the unknown, and once you plunge into the pool, then it's not so bad, it's not as cold as you thought it was, the water, and people, I think, were so irrationally fearful of integration in Mississippi and thought it was going to be so terrible, and when it happened, and it, you know, it wasn't nearly so bad as we thought it was. So, you know, yeah, the opposite reaction was not so bad. We can live with it. Guess better make the best of it. So that's the only way I can explain why things are going as well as they are. Why everybody. One thing we found out, you know, everybody talks about the Negro Black block vote, but they don't vote as a block in Mississippi as much as the whites do when it comes to race. And that's why we only have one black guy in there, because there are a lot of people down there in that house. If the Negroes had block voted against them, they wouldn't be there. They had to have black support to get elected. And they got it. And most of them appreciate it.
How has that appreciation been manifested in legislation other than that you've already discussed?
Well, just the reception, say, that the pleas of the black colleges get to their meetings. People fall all over themselves trying to build buildings and, you know, appropriate money for the black colleges that we never thought of it before. They got the vote. And that's a very practical legislation. Well, and things like this, like I say, this manpower bill, and the other significant education we passed in the program to put state money into programs designed to prepare adults to take the general education development test, which is the high school equivalent. So of course, unfortunately, a lot of people need that for a white, but probably more blacks than white. Also, you can see it in welfare legislation. You know, that used to be, you know, people get up there ranting and raving about this terrible welfare program, but they don't have much of that anymore.
Have benefits substantially increased it?
Appropriations for Medicaid, you know, we were late getting into Medicaid, but that is, I think the state appropriations for that is probably trouble since we started, and that was 1969.
To what extent is the private school movement and the fact that in many communities the decision-making local power structure have their kids in private schools, to what effect is that felt in terms of education for the private schools?
Well, of course, that was one of the things that I feared greatly, that public education would suffer. We're in these communities where the entire white population withdrew and went to private schools, and that's why I was terribly upset when, you know, total unremitting integration was ordered, because I knew what that meant in most places was resegregation. And I was afraid that it would create a block people in the legislature who could care less about public education. But that hasn't happened at all. And the only way I can explain that is that those are the places where you have the largest proportion of black voters. And the people from that area, despite the white power structure's attitude to public education, they got to listen to those black voters who are totally dedicated to public education. So they can't, you know, they can't create an anti-education block. The support of public education come from the areas where there are virtually no white children in public schools.
Let me ask you one
question. It all goes back to the power of the ballot. And I used to talk to civil rights people, and I always said, you're attacking this thing in the wrong way. You ought to get the Voting Rights Act first, and then integrate the schools, rather than vice versa. We had a lot less trouble if that had happened.
So in effect,
legislatures, they weren't a governmental power structure that wasn't totally dedicated to massive opposition.
Let me ask you a question, because you were in the legislature in 1954,
mm-hmm.
right? And for the first close to a year, am I correct, after the Brown versus Board of Education decision was handed down, that opinion was really gelling and there was no real immediate outcry to it. My question is this. At that time, James F. Burns was governor of South Carolina. He had been on the Supreme Court, considerable prestige regionally and nationally, and in almost a unique position. Before massive resistance really got underway in Virginia. If Burns at that time had made an effort, say, to bring Southern governors together and said he doesn't like the decision, he's disappointed in it, but the Supreme Court has ruled it, and it's going to be the law of the land, and we need to devise a strategy to implement it with the least amount of disruption. Would it have had any effect?
Who can tell? I don't know, but, you know, just the reaction of the average voter would be that would be, you know, the leader can't get too far out in front of the people, or it gets neck chopped off, people we're going to react against it, whatever the leaders
Even in that first year, in those first few months, when there was really not a great public outcry or reaction?
Yeah. Well, I was defeated, you know, after the Cornette administration. And that was pretty late. We weren't integrated. That was 1961. No, 63. So 1963, and schools in Vicksburg still, you know, despite Brian had in no suit, so there'd been no integration.
our legislation.
The Supreme Court says the law of the land, and we're going to have to do the best we can, but we can't close public schools just because the court orders a single black child in the school. And even in 1963, that really, I don't have any books saying that.
And you were defeated that year?
That was the only reason. Well, that was a big contribution factor.
So you were out of the legislature for how long?
I was out of the legislature from 64 to 69. 5 years. I was defeated, and then Johnson administration, I didn't run again. And that would not have ever run again. In 68, they passed the annual limited session bill. And then coincidentally, right after that session, one of the representatives from Warren County died. And had a special election. I said, for the unexpired term. I said, the last 3 years. By the legislature, some of the members of the legislature got very concerned about rapidly escalating cost of computers in state government, and so they passed a bill in 68 to set up an executive branch computer authority, and, you know, mandating them to do something about the cooperative use of computers between departments, more effective expenditure of computer dollars, and the damn thing fell flat on its face. It didn't do a thing it was supposed to do. Now, partly it was defects in the way it was set up. They didn't give them adequate powers and no money. But it could have been effective, despite the limitations on it. People gotten in the crack, but they didn't. And so when they flopped completely, the legislature said, well, the hell with it. You're not going to do it, we'll do it. So we abolished that authority and set up an authority made up of 3 members of the House and 3 members of the Senate. Learned by the mistakes, gave ourselves a lot more power than the old authority had, and also gave us enough money to hire competent staff to do the job. And I'm very proud of the job we've done. I think we probably get more computer output with the dollar put in this state than in other states in the country.
Well, does the committee administer the agency?
No. We run it. And we own every computer the state has. Nothing can be bought or sold or leased without our approval.
In terms of institutional power,
I helped set up our budget commission, which is a real power. Implemented completely legislative government. And it's not just the fact that the legislators own them, but that the membership is not appointed by the government, but it's appointed by the people of the House and the government.
Question I've been asking, in terms of institutional power, does the Speaker of the House have more than anybody in Mississippi in terms of state government?
Well, in terms of legislative functions, he does. He's got far more power than the government. But I'd say the Speaker, depending on what you're talking about, the government's still got power that he can exercise. Speaker. He's stronger than the Speaker. The Speaker of the House is the second most powerful man in the state government, and in many areas it's far more powerful than the governor.
So with Walter Sullivan, the Speaker, he stayed on and on.
Well, that's right. And of course, this is one of the main things. The Speaker we have a tradition in the state, and this is what gives us a strong legislature too, as much as anything else, is that we have a tradition of re-electing speakers. In Florida and North Carolina, they have a tradition of passing it around, and so they have a very weak speaker, and it weakens the legislature. Because they not only turn over speakers, they turn over committee chairmanships. Which means that, it just means that you don't have much power.
How are judges elected in Mississippi?
Well, they are elected legally by popular election. The Supreme Court is not elected, but you very rarely have an election. And usually somebody dies in office or resigns, and the government appoints a successor, and he announces for the election, and nobody runs against him.
The governor's
in the dodo.
Does the governor's appointee have to be confirmed by the legislature?
I don't think so, because he's a temporary appointee. He only served, the governor's appointee only served until the called election. That's exactly how it works.
The same thing apply to trial judges?
Not to such a great extent.